You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. You can hear a fan going in the background here. We've got something happening at the Radiator. There's always something exciting happening at the Radiator. So today I'm afraid we have a fan that needs a little bit of a tune-up. Today Write the Book has two segments. First, an interview with Vermont writer Susan Katz Saito, co-author with her late mother of the book Encounter with Japan, An Adventure in Love. And then after that conversation, you'll hear the second in our series of Write the Book book chats with the owner of Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, Claire Benedict. But first, let me tell you a little bit about Encounter with Japan, An Adventure in Love. This book is the story of Adelaide E. Katz, or Addie, whose experience as a young mother exchanging letters with a Japanese pen pal resulted in a life-changing trip to Japan in the turbulent 1960s. She went on to become director emeritus of special programs at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Encounter with Japan, An Adventure in Love is a collection of Addie's own journal entries, essays, and poetry, posthumously collected by her daughter, Susan Katz Saito. Susan was born in New York City and grew up in several states around the Northeast. She studied Montessori preschool teaching and was working as a playroom supervisor in the outpatient department of a Manhattan hospital when she met Toshiharu Saito, a Japanese engineer, on a business assignment in America. They married in 1974. 2 weeks later, they moved to Japan. In 1996, Susan, Toshi, and their son Ricky left Japan and settled in South Burlington, Vermont. In Japan, Susan was chosen to serve as one of only two foreigners on a 100-member committee preparing a vision for the 21st century in Shiga Prefecture. She created a volunteer group to introduce the idea of hands-on children's museums, and she designed the discovery room for the Lake Biwa Museum, which opened in 1996 in Kusatsu, Japan. In Vermont, Susan continues to write and offers programs on Japan for adults and children. Her husband, Toshi, is the president of the Japan-America Society of Vermont. Although Encounter with Japan could well have been the title of a book about Susan's own life in Japan, that is another story yet to come. And as you'll hear during the interview, she's actually starting to work on that book. I spoke to Susan Katz Saito last week. I began our interview by asking her to talk about how she came to create Encounter with Japan, An Adventure in Love.
Well, I had this really fantastic mother. Not perfect, mind you, but pretty fantastic. And she was dying of brain cancer in 2008. And I was sitting by her bed all day long, all night long. She was in hospice. My sister and I took turns. And I wanted to be able to leave her with something. I didn't know if she, you know, could hear me or not, but you know, you always hear people saying after they've gotten married or they've had children or you know, some big thing has happened in their lives, I wish my mother had been alive to see, or my father, you know, could be here. And I said, I want to give her a gift. I want to send her off knowing for sure that I and my sister Miriam, that we would be trying to do something with her writing, mm-hmm. because she was a fantastic writer and was rarely published. So I said, Mom, I held her hand, and I said, I found some of these Japanese papers, and I was looking at some of your other things, and Miriam and I are going to do everything we can to get as much of your stuff published as possible. She had a Regency romance that she wrote when she was about 80.
Oh, really?
Which is pretty fascinating. I think I mentioned it briefly in the book just to give a better picture of who she was.
Yeah.
And I said to my sister, we need to find a professional editor to look at it and see, is this something that can be worked into something publishable? Because she'd only sent it off to one place. She couldn't even get an agent. Mm-hmm. And I've read how difficult it is nowadays to get even agents. It's almost as difficult as to get into a publisher. So I left her with these thoughts that something was going to be done. And I kind of felt that she heard me. And then, of course, I felt I was going to have to actually follow through.
Sure.
She's either sitting on my shoulder there, you know, saying, okay, Susan, come on, get writing. And not so much because she'd want her stuff printed, but because she would want me writing, because
uh-huh.
that's the way she was.
Yeah. So let's see. How did she get involved in the Letters Abroad program originally?
Okay. It's very strange, but I had forgotten, and it is not in the book, but we were living in the Berkshires, and I do have some of her writing about that, you know, this interminable winter, which she wasn't used to.
Uh-huh.
It was even worse than Rochester, New York, which where we had lived several times. But my grandmother had found in New York City, right? We're in a little village in Massachusetts, Hinsdale. But my grandmother found a little article about Letters Abroad, this pen pal agency, and sent it to my mother. And my mother wrote to them and asked for a pen pal. And it's really strange because I am not sure what the timing was of it, but I had a pen pal. And the pen pal that I had, the first one that I had, was one who my mother was supposedly matched up with. She was matched up with Suzue Matsubara, her real pen pal. She was matched up with her, but there was a young woman who was just a little older than me, about 1 or 2 years older, and she passed her on to me.
Oh.
So we maintained correspondence for quite a while, and then after I married my husband and went to Japan, I did get to meet her. That's a whole other very funny, interesting story. But
now, it's interesting that you didn't include that in the book. So were you trying not to highlight anybody but your mother?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. My writing in this book is, I don't know if I have typical writing. It may be similar to my mother. My mother always considered herself a humorous essayist, and we've got tons of wonderful things that she's written. I find that I often inject humor in. I did not. I think I made a concerted effort not to, because I wanted my voice. I wanted this to be about her,
mm-hmm.
not about me. And I tried to stay in the background. And one friend of mine said, do you know, your writing is a lot like your mother's writing. And I said, thank you. And, it wasn't intentional. As I say, I tried consciously at the beginning, and then I think it just, you know, became a habit.
Right.
Just to keep it calm and quiet and bring the threads together mm-hmm. of the other writing, the other information. And I think it was successful.
It was, and I thought that you did a really lovely job of interweaving her poems, her journal writings, and your own memories that honor her, but obviously give just another point of view that kind of rounds out the whole story, which mm-hmm. I thought was really nice.
And, of course, I couldn't resist in her journal the things that she had left out. And I put in brackets, and people really, when they read this book, they must read what I've written. Well, not necessarily the acknowledgments, but at least the preface, because it explains that in brackets is my writing covering stuff that she did not cover, which was actually kind of surprising to me, that the whole party, the welcome party, was not in there, and it was such a big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
she was probably exhausted.
Yeah, I guess so.
Right?
Yeah.
She was very good about keeping her journals
right?
pretty complete. Right.
Right.
Eleanor Roosevelt was involved in the program,
yes.
in the Letters Abroad program. I love Eleanor Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if your mother ever talked about her impressions. At this point, Eleanor Roosevelt was a former first lady. Did your mother ever talk about her impressions of her?
She just said she was fantastic, but this is something that killed me when I was working on this book. I could not find anything written, and it may still be, I didn't go through every single piece of paper.
Right.
But She met her. She visited her in her brownstone after the return from Japan, because she was in New York at the beginning, wined and dined, etc., a meeting with UN officials. Then went to Japan, came back, and it was, okay, what, debriefing maybe is the way you could call it.
Right.
And I did speak with, there was another winner, which I mentioned in their Kenneth book out from Atlanta.
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't get all the publicity she did.
Mm.
And I think it's probably because he went to Paris, which was not so unusual in 1960.
Yeah.
She was going to Japan 15 years after the war.
Yeah.
She was a 35-year-old housewife with three children, and he was a 26-year-old single guy. And she was eloquent. She was bouncy. She was much more newsworthy. And
yeah.
I'm sure that's why Life magazine covered her trip and not his trip. But I talked to Kenneth. I'd never met him, never spoken with him. I called him. I mean, looked him up, found him, called him when I was working on the book. And he said that he was supposed to, you know, separately meet with Mrs. Roosevelt after the trip. He forgot. He had the appointment. He forgot. He wrote to her. And she said, don't worry about it the next time you're in New York. He said she was so gracious. The next time you're in New York, contact me, and we'll have you over then. And he did.
Oh, that's great.
Yes.
He had a second chance.
Right.
My goodness.
Yes.
Forget a meeting with Eleanor Roosevelt.
I know. That's what I said. Oh, my gosh.
As you've already said, your mother was Addie.
Mm-hmm.
Her pen pal was a Japanese widow,
mm-hmm.
correct? A single mother named Susui Matsubara.
Susue, yes.
Susue Matsubara. And they had an instant connection through their letters.
Oh,
they
was,
had a lot in common.
Oh, I mean, I write in the book, I actually use the expression, it was uncanny. It really was uncanny how perfectly matched they were.
Yeah.
Just amazing when you read Addie's writing and the things that, you know, she felt were important. You read Suzue's writing, and this is her second language.
Mm-hmm.
She woke up at something like 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning to listen on the radio to the English language program.
I was going to ask if she spoke, so they both wrote in English.
They both wrote in English.
There were no translators involved.
Right, not until she actually made the trip there.
Yeah.
And then Suzue's oldest child, her son Hiroshi, did interpreting, and then she invited her niece from Tokyo, she was a university student, invited her to come and to interpret for her.
I was really touched by Hiroshi's letter that he wrote to her when
she left
Japan.
I read that letter out loud to him and to his sisters and husband of the one sister who's married when we visited in Kyoto the time before last. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house when I got finished reading it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it gives me goosebumps every time I read it.
Right.
And I use it sometimes when I give a talk about the book. I use it because I'm saying all these wonderful things about my mother, pointing out all of these and what a fantastic experience it was for her. But for everyone who she touched, there was an equal type of experience, a life-changing.
And we should say for the recording that he wrote this beautiful letter talking about how much her trip had meant to him and how much he looked at her as almost like an American mother.
Mm-hmm. He referred to her as, I have a second mother.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just so moving.
Yeah. And then Suzue's whole family was so welcoming of your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really wonderful. And part of that seemed to me that it was a very big deal for them to have this visitor, this emissary from another country. Another thing that struck me when I was reading your book about your mother was that these were very simple times. These were simpler times. The idea of having a pen pal seems almost quaint now. The huge amount of press that your mother's visit to Japan created would probably not be the case today. And then the thing that really floored me, she almost missed her plane to Honolulu, right? And she convinced the airline to reopen the door of the departing plane.
It would never happen now.
Never happen now. Were you struck by this when you were writing the book, how much simpler the times were?
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is almost a period piece. And 1960, 15 years after the war, was a particularly special time because 1960 was the 100th anniversary of diplomatic relations between Japan and America.
Mm.
And the diplomatic relations, but something else is happening. There has just been a security pact that was signed between Japan and the United States. And so, you know, this is a very historic time. Eisenhower is supposed to be visiting at around the same time that my mother is. But they had to cancel his visit because there were very violent demonstrations against the security pact.
Mm.
And they were not because the Japanese were anti-American. It was because they found themselves, again, so vulnerable. They had been bombed. They were the only country to have been bombed, and it was 15 short years before. And here, aligning themselves with the United, I mean, with either of them, or either the Soviet Union or these two nuclear superpowers, aligning with one of them made you very vulnerable to the other and was very frightening for them.
Yeah.
So this is a very historical time, this 1960.
Yeah, yeah. We've already mentioned that you intersperse your mother's journal entries and her poetry and your memories and also some of your own poetry in the book. And I'm wondering if you can read an excerpt from the book that includes a little bit of each of these things.
Oh, yes, I would be delighted to. Well, this is the beginning of Chapter 13, Return to Japan, 1983, which is kind of a strange place to start, but... this is the only chapter in which there's any of my poetry. And the reason that there is any poetry of mine in this book is because Jim Ellefson from the poet in residence of Champlain College had very kindly read the manuscript, and he had been very taken by the section which is a college paper that Addie wrote in 71, I think it was, which was done in a style called, a Japanese style called haibun, and that it combines prose and poetry. So there's a paragraph or two about an experience, and then the poems that grew out of this experience. And Jim wrote to me and said, you know, I really like this idea of haibun, and I think in order to make it more a mother-daughter thing, you should write some poems. And I wrote back to him, and I said, Jim, I can't write poetry like that. I can't write anything like that on demand. It has to, like, suddenly well up inside of me, and generally happens when I'm in the middle of sleeping or in the shower, things like that. But then, without even intending, these two just came when I was working on this chapter, and I'm kind of pleased with them.
Okay.
I'm very self-critical, but there are some things that I've done that, wow, they don't feel like me. They feel like someone else. And whoa, this is wonderful. Someday I'll get to a point where, yeah, this is me.
Yeah.
And, wow, I love it. So this is called Return to Japan, 1983. We now backtrack to 1983. The year was a momentous one for Addie. Aside from receiving her PhD, she had a radical mastectomy, and her only grandchild was born. Toshi, my husband, had been promising Addie a trip to Japan as a gift for earning her doctorate. So, in brilliantly colored November, when our son was 3 months old and my mother had recovered enough from the surgery to contemplate taking such a difficult trip, Addie returned to Japan 23 years after her first visit. We were hoping that Life and the newspapers would want to do articles on the return and the changes she found. It seemed like a good human interest story to us, but times had changed and so had Life. With a capital L-I-F-E. Addie did not write poetry during this trip and kept just a very short journal. Much of it was devoted to her grandson and pithy observations of his mother's and father's parenting skills, such as the following. He's, that's Toshi in brackets, a bit nutty about overprotecting his son. You'd think the baby was made of sugar frosting or some type of fragile meringue. Susan catches the goofiness and I'm in the middle sounding like a witch or an old bag, telling them, this is a flesh-and-blood three-month-old, and he is truly not that dainty or delicate. They must cut the crap before this very smart kiddo really starts to play them both like violins. My mother, the prophet, whose words reverberate in the music my son plays. We took her to visit Toshi's parents. In her journal, Addie, always a lover of good food, described her favorite dishes prepared by Toshi's mother, like the thick, deep-fried tofu, simmered with sweet, orange-fleshed kabocha squash, in a broth seasoned with sugar and soy sauce. Their home is in a village of about 200 houses, nestled at the foot of a mountain in Fukui Prefecture. The Saito house is the next-to-last one before the woods and the mountain really begin. Next to it is the Buddhist priest's home and the temple, with its large curving roof of blue-gray tiles. A path beyond the temple leads upwards to a small Shinto shrine. From beneath its roof, a colorful fat silk rope and brass gong hang above a weathered wooden box for donations. Addie took the path through the towering cedars to the shrine and was much affected by the experience. It's a real mind trip. Druids and all their ilk would love this place. I could come again and again. It's not elegantly manicured as the Buddhist temple grounds tend to be. This is woodland sprite and spirit area. While walking, she picked up what she called treasures. I found them 25 years later in a yellowing envelope marked Treasures from the Shinto Shrine near Toshi's parents' home. The treasures were acorns and pottery shards. Treasures found on the mossy ground, lovingly held in the palm of her hand. Blue and white shards and brown acorns, saved in a folded white envelope.
Thank you for reading
You're
that.
Welcome.
So those two poems were poems by Susan Katz Saito, who's written this book about her mother's encounter with Japan. You know, you said something right before you did the reading that reminded me of your mother, actually. You said something about being a little bit self-critical. And I found her personality in this book was really interesting because she was very excited about what she was doing and she was very proud to be this emissary from the United States to Japan. But she was kind of self-critical, too, sometimes.
Yeah.
She would get down on herself. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about her personality and also how this trip might have affected and changed her.
Well, I think that one of the problems is that her marriage was eroding at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she had some mixed feelings. I may be wrong, but I got the feeling that this going away was such a, you know, wonderful, wonderful chance for her, wonderful experience for her. But she had always been the one who supported her husband in all ways, and she sometimes apparently consciously stayed in the background. I mean, anybody who knew her, it's hard to believe that she stayed in the background. But there was a something in her that apparently did hold back to some extent. And I think, I'm not sure whether before the marriage became endangered, it was like that, or whether when she had the realization and it was so vulnerable at that point. And the going away and the leaving not only the kids behind, which when you read her journal, it's just amazing. Here she's having this fantastic experience. You think you just forget about everything back home. And she threw herself into it. Mm-hmm. I mean, she didn't have to throw herself into it. She just was in it. But at the same time, when she worries about the things back home, the kids, are they all right? I hope, you know, we were all separated. We'd never been separated before. And then our brother, who was still, you know, very young, was one place, and my sister and I were another place. Father was another. But I think that this going away for her to be there and to be spotlighted, which she definitely was, made such a big difference in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And she was actually, after she came back from Japan, because of the Life magazine article, she was invited to appear on television,
mm-hmm.
on the radio. She gave talks all over. This went on for about 2 years.
Wow.
And CDs of her on television and radio. They were reel-to-reel tapes.
Oh.
That I had cleaned up. They're treasures. They're unbelievable. You get to hear her. The last two talks I did, I played one of these recordings from television. It was her third visit on that program, and then she was on it one or two more times after that because she was such a, you know, popular guest.
Mm.
Out of Boston, some radio station wanted her to actually host a program which would have thoroughly changed her life. But, you know, her husband was the head of the family and where his job was. And, you know, we kids often, as adults, talked about this and wondered, what if she had taken that job and how different her life would have been? Because she was fantastic.
Yeah.
She spoke beautifully. She was so interesting.
One of the things I was going to ask you about was when she was on her trip, your mother was treated to many special tours and teas and music lessons and concerts. And after one concert, which I think was toward the end of the trip, she was very moved and wanted to repay them in kind. And so she sang a Jewish song for the gathered audience. And I was wondering, what song did she sing?
I don't know it.
Oh.
If I played it, maybe you would know it. I did not, you know, I was thinking, whoa, you know, Hatikva or something like that would, you know.
Right.
Lots of people know it, but this song I didn't know. She sang it in Hebrew. It's beautiful.
Okay. I think what I love most about this book is your mother's energy and spirit, which is what you were just talking about. At one point, she writes in her journal about her upcoming trip. This is before she went initially to Japan. It's not all fun and games. It's an opportunity for one American housewife to try to erase a few of the misconceptions about America and bring back a little of the truth about life in Japan. I believe so strongly in this kind of international diplomacy. I want to convert the world. I loved that, and I loved her spirit, and I wondered if she infused this kind of idealism in her children.
Oh, absolutely.
Well. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All three of us, I'm married to a Japanese.
Right, so I wondered about that. Now, were you always interested in Japanese culture after her trip?
I was the one in the family who had the least interest in Japan.
Oh, really? That's so interesting.
Yes, so we every once in a while, we sit and we chuckle about the fact that I'm the one who ended up marrying the Japanese, moving to Japan in 74, and not moving back until 96.
You were there all that time.
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's my next book. That is my next book. I'm working on it.
So 22
essays.
Years, my yeah. goodness.
Well, I had time off for good behavior. We had an assignment in outside of Paris. We had one in New York State. We had one in Vermont.
So this was what was your work?
No, my husband's assignment. Sorry, he worked for IBM.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see.
I was a playroom supervisor in a hospital.
Oh, okay.
That's what I was.
All right. How long did it take you to learn the language?
Probably 20-odd years, and I'm not finished.
Oh, yeah, it's a very difficult language.
I didn't study. Instead, I learned by living. Mm. There was no other English-speaking person living in the town where we lived.
Wow.
So if I wanted to talk, I had to speak in Japanese.
Yeah, so that's the way to learn, isn't it?
Yeah, so, you know, you have regional dialects, and we were outside of Kyoto. So people who come from the Tokyo area, when they meet me, and we're speaking in Japanese even now, they say, ha ha, either Kyoto-ben, which is, you know, Kyoto dialect, or Kansai-ben, which is the area, instead of Kanto. Kanto is the area that Tokyo's in.
Okay.
But, yeah.
That's great. Oh, well, I wanted to ask you, Susan, who are a few of your favorite authors?
Adult or children?
Whatever you enjoy reading.
You know, when I was a kid, of course, I read children's books. Then, as I started to get older, I, of course, started reading more adult books. I started reading more adult books as I was, maybe 11, 12, 13, was reading on college level. And as I got even older, I went back to the children's books, and I still, a good young adult book will get me excited. Whenever things are not that great in my life, I'm feeling crappy, I will go back and I'll read Stuart Little or Charlotte's Web or Mary Poppins. Not that lousy movie. the real book. Yeah. But I grew up with, of course, as I think everybody of my age did, Dr. Seuss, and so many kids still are. So rhyme was in my blood from the time I was small. Well, I was exposed to poetry by my my grandmother and my mother. But
how about any adult authors that might have influenced you as a writer?
As a writer, you know, it's really funny. I don't think I'm consciously aware of having been influenced.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes some of the poets, I'll find a line that I'm using that that is reminiscent mm-hmm. of a poet. But, you know, again, most of those were going back to childhood poems. Mm-hmm. Robert Louis Stevenson and Lewis Carroll and who else? Poe. There were things about Poe I liked and a lot that I didn't. In school, I always hated when we had to read Shakespeare and then tear it apart. And what did he mean here? I never, ever enjoyed doing that. I've never belonged to a book club because I don't like tearing things apart. I love language, exquisite language. I just love the flow of the words. Dylan Thomas, when you and I were in touch, I suddenly had this realization thinking about books over the years. I realized that when I was younger, I really enjoyed biographies. Mm. And I didn't remember that, but yeah, there was a long stretch of biographies. And this is my first biography. I've done a lot of other writing, children's books, and I don't know what you call it, memoir or not, about activities in Japan, and various essays. But I've never done a biography before, and I found I really, really enjoyed doing this biography. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, we talked before about me consciously, to begin with, consciously keeping my voice out of it, in a sense.
Right, right, right. But
maybe what I liked about the biography is that it's not about my voice, it's about someone else's voice.
Yeah. Well, that kind of segues nicely into my last question for you, which is, do you have any advice for writers who want to see the work of a loved one in print?
Well, I didn't even think about it. I just jumped into it. The whole thing, planned that I was going to do something.
Right, right.
I didn't anticipate doing what I did. But for other people, what I would suggest is go through the papers. Mm-hmm. Go through the papers first. And I found that many of them jumped out at me. Some of them were just so perfect for what I thought I wanted to say. And I thought, oh, this illustrates it beautifully. So I took a bit from here or there. There is one long one when she was feeling depressed that I broke up. Mm-hmm. And I think I put the back part at the beginning of the book, and then I do mention that I have done this. But it really is hard to
You're glad
make a suggestion.
You did it.
Oh, I am very glad I did it.
Do you feel like your mother would have enjoyed reading this book?
When I sent my sister a copy of the finished book, she wrote back to me. She said, Susan, I cried.
Oh.
She said, Mom would have been so proud of you.
Yeah.
See, not happy that you wrote about me, but that you wrote, that you created this beautiful piece of writing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, no.
And it's a wonderful tribute to her.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, I want to thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Susan Katz-Saito. You can learn more about her work at encounterwithjapan.weebly.com, and that's spelled W-E-E-B-L-Y. Now it's time to air the second of my book chats with Claire Benedict, owner of Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. Claire and I talk every few months about books that are newly out in the world and what she thinks of the books she's read recently.
I'm here with Claire Benedict of Bear Pond Books, and I want to welcome you back to Write the Book.
Thanks, Sheila.
Thank you for being on the show. So we're going to talk about some new book recommendations that you have. What's the first one on your list?
Well, I have to talk about The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt that came out recently because I just love it so much. I want everybody to read it. So I'll tell you a little bit about it. It's the story of 13-year-old Theo Decker, who is this boy in New York City, and he's with his mother when she's killed in a terrorist bombing at an art museum. And he manages to survive and escape unharmed, and with him he takes this small 17th century Dutch painting called The Goldfinch that he and his mother had gone to see, the reason why they were in the museum.
So he takes it?
He takes
okay.
it in the aftermath of the museum being all in rubble.
Okay.
Nobody notices him take it. And then that's the beginning of the book.
So it's quite
interesting. So he goes from there. Now he's an orphan because his father's nowhere to be found.
How old is he?
He's 13. So he goes to live with a schoolmate in their Park Avenue penthouse. And then his father turns up, so he's sent to live in Las Vegas in a suburban new development that hasn't been finished, so it's basically deserted before it was ever filled in. And he has adventures there with meets a Russian friend, Boris. And, you know, and then eventually he's back in New York living in downtown with antique dealers. And he just has these incredible, it's all over the place. He meets all these great characters. There's Boris, his best friend. There's eventually this perfect waspy girl who becomes his girlfriend. There's the mentor, his antiques dealer mentor, who introduces him to the world of art and antiquities. And there's this beautiful girl who he pines after forever.
Who's not the waspy girl.
She's the one who got away. And she was also in the bombing, and that's how he knows her. But they're both so scarred that they just can't make their own connection between the two of them. And so, I mean, there's just this wonderful cast of characters. Every character is so well written, so well realized. She really does an amazing job. Mm-hmm. It deals with all these issues of love and friendship, hope, and of course loss, because Theo is just always grief. He's a grief-stricken, you know, scarred young man, but he is always trying to do what he needs to do to keep going forward. And it's beautiful. It has beautiful emotion.
Now, I know in the previous books I've read by Donna Tartt, there's always sort of a thread of mystery. Even if the book itself is not a mystery, there's like always some sort of mysterious situation that kind of pulls you along. Does that exist here?
All along in this book, Theo does have this stolen piece of art. And no one knows he has it, but everyone knows this piece of art is missing. So at some point in the book, there's art thieves and international antique theft.
Wow.
And he ends up at one point in Amsterdam, and it all goes all over the place, but in a really satisfying way.
You know, it's impressive. She takes so long to write a book, but she really does a lot with each of her books.
Yeah. This is really kind of the sweeping epic, but it takes place over a short period of time. It's, you know, he starts when he's 13 and ends when he's maybe 30 or something.
Okay.
But it's just the different places he goes and the different people he encounters, and it's all just so rich, and you can just picture all of it so nicely.
Yeah.
She portrays it all so well and wonderfully. It's just beautiful.
A lot of the press has been about the length of the book, so we should talk about that. Did you have any problem with the length?
No. The book, it's very long, and I think that it was not one page too long.
Okay.
It was exactly what it needed to be, and every page was wonderful. So I had no problem with the length of the book.
Okay, wonderful. What's next on the list?
Another book that I really have loved is called We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves by Karen Joy Fowler. And this is a really engaging book. This is a book that by page two or three, I was like, I love this author. Why haven't I read every book by this author? She is just so wonderful. She just has this great style of writing and just immediately draws you in. And this is about a young woman. She's a college student named Rosemary, and she's telling a story about her family. And both her brother and her sister are missing for reasons that are not explained at the beginning of the story. And she's talking about how, she's wounded by their loss, by the fact that they're not around or whatever happened to them. But nobody in her family talks about it. It's a big secret. Nobody likes to talk about anything, and everything's just kind of a cover-up. And she's gotten to the point where she's not satisfied with that anymore. I can't tell you too much about the story because it's not a mystery, but it's just kind of nice to let the reader discover it on their own.
Okay.
I hate to give away too much, but it's really engaging. It's funny and it's very charming. The main character is really enjoyable. And it's also kind of heart-wrenching at points. It's, there's, you know, what happened in this family is very sad and poignant, and it's really well done.
Okay. But it's funny, too.
It's funny.
Okay. All right, good. Because funny, you know, it's funny. I can take sad if there's a little funny.
Yeah. And not heavy-handed sad. Okay. Not, like, you know, manipulative sad.
All right.
Just touching and poignant.
Okay. So that's Karen Joy Fowler. Mm-hmm. We are all completely beside ourselves. So what's next on your list?
Another good one is A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki.
Okay. This author's name has come up so many times in my book suggestions, and I have not yet read her, so
yeah,
I need
she's
to read
good.
Her.
She wrote My Year of Meats,
right,
which was really popular. I never read her before either, and a friend recommended her, and absolutely fascinating woman.
she's a Buddhist.
She's a
monk.
She's a Buddhist monk. She's a Buddhist priest.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Okay.
And she's of Japanese descent. I believe she's Japanese Canadian.
Okay.
Descent. This book is quite original. It starts with this wonderful premise. It's about this young girl, Now. She's 16 years old, and she lives in Tokyo.
Her name is Now. Okay.
She's Japanese. She lives in Tokyo, and she's decided to write the story of her 104-year-old anarchist Zen Buddhist nun grandmother. So already, how great is that? So she decides to write this all down.
Right.
In a journal. And as she's doing so, she also tells her own story. And it's a little bit of her own cry for help as well, because she's a teenager with adolescent angst and some family issues of her own. So she decides to write it all down. And after she does so, she wraps it all up in a Hello Kitty lunchbox, and she launches it into the sea.
Okay.
And she's waiting for somebody to find it. And she's written it all for whoever finds it. This one person, who she calls her time being.
For the time being. Cool.
And it is found by a woman named Ruth, who is of Japanese-Canadian descent.
Mm. Also named Ruth, interesting.
who lives on a remote island in British Columbia, as does Ruth Ozeki.
Okay.
So she finds it and is reading the journal, and you're going back and forth between the two stories of it being written and it being read.
Okay.
Which is clearly different times. And this novel is very creative in the way that their stories kind of cross time and space, and it gets a little bit, it gets interesting in there.
Okay.
It's very, very original, as you can tell.
Now, sometimes when you go back and forth between time and narrators, there will be one time or narrator who is your favorite. Has that happened for you, or was this well managed in both?
Well, I think it's a little heavier on the Japanese girl in Tokyo's story.
Okay.
Is the predominant story, and I think that is the one you're supposed to focus on the most.
Okay.
It's not split exactly between the two. So
right.
That is the stronger story, but they're both good stories.
Okay. Because I remember, I probably shouldn't do this, but anyway, I remember when I read the story Sarah's Key.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back and forth between
right.
the story of a child during the Holocaust and this journalist. And I so preferred one of those stories to the other.
Right. Sometimes you're like, you just want to get
right.
done with one, like move along.
Right.
Get back to the one you like.
Yeah. Okay, so that sounds great. A Tale for the Time
yeah.
Being, Ruth Ozeki.
Yeah, so there's a great Italian book. It's translated from the Italian. Apparently it was quite popular there, called My Brilliant Friend by Elena Ferrante.
Okay.
And this is a Europa Editions book, and they're releasing all their books in paperback, which is nice. If you like to buy a paperback instead of a hardcover. This book is the first part of a trilogy.
Are they all out, or is it...
Just the first two are out
okay.
now. This first one came out last year, and the second one just came out recently. And it's called My Brilliant Friend, and it's about the friendship of these two young women, Elena and Lila. They live in a village on the outskirts of Naples in the 1950s. And it's about their friendship, about the paths that are available to them as young women in this pretty hard place to live.
Right.
It's about the transition that Italian society was going through at that time. It's about, you know, jealousies between them and opportunities. And it's what I really liked about it was that it was an Italian view of Italian life. I think we've all read novels or memoirs about Americans in Italy.
Right, right.
But this is...
Under the Tuscan sun.
Right. This is an under the Tuscan sun. And it's not beautiful. It was a hard life. It's a violent life, at least wow. in this story. You know, and the opportunities for women were extremely limited. You know, they were limited to... Limited amounts of schooling was available to them. Lots of abuse from men was available to them. Mm-hmm. You know, it was it wasn't really an easy place to live. And so it just was a really interesting story.
And that would be interesting because another one that featured Italy around that same time period was Beautiful Ruins, but that's all very sort of romanticized.
Yeah. And, yeah. I mean, it's not all horrible or anything, but you just see the reality of what it was like to be a woman in the 50s in a village in Naples. It's not not all great.
Yeah.
Sure, there was good food, and it was probably pretty, but there were some realities, too.
Yeah, okay. All right,
great. And the second one that just came out is called The Story of a New Name, and that's about the same two characters.
Okay.
All right. They're called the Neapolitan novels.
Hmm. Interesting. All right, great. Now, you had one other paperback you were going to talk about, which I've heard of before, but I have not yet read it. So I wonder if we can talk about that one.
Yeah, The Silent Wife by A.S.A. Harrison. I think it was a bestseller this summer. And it's a little bit of a thriller mystery, but not really either a thriller or a mystery.
Okay.
It's one of those books where... You know in the beginning what the crime is going to be?
Oh, you know, that was like The Secret History.
Yeah.
She said that on page 2, you know.
Okay.
Right.
Interesting. So there's not really a mystery, but what the story is about is how and why and what's leading up to this inevitable murder. And it's fun. It's a husband and wife. It's fun. Yeah, there's a murder. It's fun. It's a husband and wife. It turns out they're not actually married. It's a long-time couple, been together forever, as if husband and wife. The husband decides that he's moving on because, he's impregnated one of his mistresses, so he needs to move on and deal with that. And the wife is not really okay with that. She's not okay with him moving on. She's not okay with a pregnant mistress. None of it. none of it. But she's an interesting character. She's not... she doesn't deal with it the way you think she might, which is not just to say murder. There's a number of ways she reacts. And the chapters go back and forth, again, back and forth between the two of them.
Okay.
And it is satisfying because they're quick. This is a quick read because it moves along quickly and you want to find out what happened so you don't put it down very much. And so you go back and forth hearing her story and what's going on and his story and what's going on. And surprise, surprise, they have very different perspectives. And so it leads up to an inevitable crime and... It's just fun. Just a fun
And I've heard it compared a lot to Gone Girl. Do you feel like that's an apt comparison or
not
a convenient
really. I mean,
one?
It's a convenient one. I think they would love to be the next Gone Girl. I won't say it was as good as Gone Girl, but it was good.
Okay.
I think because it goes back and forth between the two, the husband and wife telling the story, that it's a pretty easy comparison to Gone Girl. But Gone Girl was a different book.
Okay. All right.
So Gone Girl is much more of a psychological thriller, I think, than this one.
Okay. All right. And then we have time for one more book.
Well, I liked Richard Russo's memoir, Elsewhere, that I think came out last year and is out in paperback now. It is the story of his mother and his relationship with his mother. And it's really, I mean, anybody who's read Richard Russo knows he's a beautiful writer.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell he's a great guy.
Yeah.
just can tell. And so he wrote this story about his mother, who he grew up with as... only child of a single parent in upstate New York, set in this dying mill town or factory town in upstate New York. His mother was not entirely mentally healthy, which is not something he realized until much later in life, but she was a handful. And he was her caretaker. And it's a story, it's just a story about her, and it's so sweetly told, just beautifully written. And he keeps himself out of it. It's not about him. You know, it's not one of these things and like, well, let me tell you about my story and with my mother. No, it's really about his mother. He is a peripheral character and he doesn't talk about his career a lot or something like that. So he's not using it for self-promotion, is what I'm trying to say. And it's just about the relationship that they had. And it's just very tender and beautifully done.
And so he's able to convey her limitations while still conveying affection. And
yes, yeah. Yes.
So it's not just like critical, my mother did this.
No, it's not one of these like, oh, what a horrible mother I had, can you believe this? And okay. I grew up anyway. No, he helped her to the very end. I mean, he showed patience that I'm not sure I could have ever shown. And so did his wife.
Yeah.
I don't know what she knew what she was signing up for, but they were very nice people.
Wonderful. Okay, so that's a lot of great book suggestions for the near future. Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Claire.
It's been fun. Thank you for having me.
So, there you go. Some great new book suggestions to look into, and I hope you enjoyed that. I will list those books again on the podcast site with links to Bear Pond. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com. And by VCAM. VCAM has a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More information at vermontcam.org. It is a wonderful organization. That's actually where I've had the good fortune to record a couple of televised interviews with authors for RETN. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my first guest, Susan Katz Saito. Write a story that is true, but sounds like it's not true, or a story that is not true, but sounds like it is true. A Japanese mime and storyteller from Massachusetts gave that as an exercise during the only storytelling workshop Susan has ever attended. She thought it sounded like a good one. So good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. I'm going to close out today's show with a recording, a wonderful recording, that Susan Katz Saito kindly loaned me. It is a recording of her mother, Addie Katz, singing a Jewish song for her Japanese hosts during her visit to Japan over 50 years ago, and I hope you enjoy it. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.
Lo hishkamti im shachal agan liyodo bizei atapai meyolam viyamim arukim viyotim arukim viyotim shelkati minomei Agalamu satalumu lanatati poli vishir Veyolamu tahati betrelet shokto uvitom shelkine Salamti Salam O Kineret Shelly O Kineret Shelly Echayi Ahalamti